Digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
Well, today my guest on Digging in the Dirt is Leah Penniman, a farmer and co-director and program manager of Soulfire Farm in upstate New York. And now she's the author of a new book called Farming While Black, a comprehensive how-to guide that is specifically aimed at African heritage growers seeking healthy food independence and reclaiming their place in American agriculture. But, you know, it's much more than that. It's an activist manual to effect change. It's a highly detailed program of best practices for all aspiring farmers. But it's also a history lesson, a rumination of what the experience of blacks have had under slavery and right up to the present day. And Leah does it all with a refreshing honesty and a whole lot of love. So welcome, Leah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we just came out of the music from the new album called Our Native Daughters, the new Rhiannon Giddens album. And the whole album.
They're my favorite band of the month by far.
Oh, yeah? So you're familiar with the album.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we just played the song Moon Meets the Sun. And I thought it was a great way to introduce your book to my audience because you guys are plowing a lot of the same fields, but in different rows.
Ashe, that is the truth.
Yep. So tell me why you wanted to write this book.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, first and foremost, Farming While Black is a love letter to my teenage self. So I've been farming since I was 16. And while I've always loved it and was really certain that was my destiny, I went through a period of disillusionment because at every conference I went to, you know, every book that I read published by Chelsea Green, it was representing white and mostly male voices. And folks in my black community started to question why I was spending my time with soil and trees and not on more important issues, you know, like gun violence and the housing crisis and education. And so it was really important for me as an adult farmer to recraft and reframe the story of black folks' relationship to land so it's not just defined and circumscribed by enslavement, but rather uplifts the, you know, thousands of years of noble and dignified relationship between black agriculturalists and the land, and to provide a model and example for that next generation of black and brown farmers, because I didn't have that, and I definitely needed that book.
So this journey for you started when you were 16.
That's true, yes.
Hmm. So, you know, I interview a lot of farmers on this show and know what a hard life you've chosen. Yeah, I mean, it is plain hard work on many levels. And you do it, and you're a farmer, and you're a mother, and you run at least one organization out of Soulfire Farm. You do public speaking, and very well, I might add. And then you find time to write such a comprehensive book to help the black community understand their place in American agriculture and try to be successful at it. How do you do that?
Well, that's a very generous overview. I mean, I can do that because I'm part of a team. So while certainly when Soulfire started, I was doing most of the labor myself and managing it, you know, over time our team has grown. So Larissa Jacobson's our farm manager. We have a couple full-time farmers on the team. So I take care of the perennials. And other than that, most of the farming I do is while I'm teaching farming. That frees me up to run the organization and all the education programs and write and speak and all of that. So it's definitely a team effort, which is not to say that we aren't all super overworked as most farmers are. You know, we know what it's like to put in a 70 or 80 hour week on a regular basis. And luckily, this life has called us. And so there's a deep meaning to the work. It's not just drudgery.
Right. Well, you make it's from your book. You can see that you're really tackling it on a lot of different levels. And one of the things that rings true to me from what you're saying is that you're trying to get the youth involved because there's no connection to the land necessarily through the black community right now. It's been lost quite extensively.
Yeah, you know, and it's not that there's none. There's certainly a legacy and plenty of elders who are holding on, but there are a number of young folks who don't have the opportunity to be out on the land because of a whole history of, you know, being driven off the land in the South and redlining and housing discrimination that have really ghettoized our folks. And so, you know, when people do come out to the land, a lot of times that first association is a traumatic one. It's with slavery and sharecropping. And it's been so powerful for young folks to see a model of farmers who look like them, who listen to the same music as them, who dress cool, talk cool, you know, to say, oh, maybe there is this possibility for me as a young person, I could grow up and potentially produce my own food, build my own house, take care of my community and not be completely dependent on this capitalist system that frankly is not out for my best interest and rather is out to consume my community.
So, you know, I recently read a book by Walter Mosley called John Woman, and it's about a deconstructionist historian who believes that if you control the content of history, what people think has come before you, then you have the near absolute power associated with that knowledge. And he challenges the accepted narrative of what has happened in history. Reading your book, that's exactly what you do with a lot of your stories. You want to comment about that kind of thing?
Sure. You know, I'm not familiar with that theory, but I'll definitely check it out. And I do think that there's power in how story is told. It's certainly told by the victor. And I did not know, for example, before doing the research for this book, that a lot of practices that we use in sustainable farming that we take for granted as ahistorical come out of the Black agrarian tradition. So everything from leguminous cover cropping to raised beds and vermicomposting, you know, everything from the CSA to pick your own. You know, this has roots in Tuskegee University, in ancient Egypt, in sub-Saharan Africa. And it was very important to uncover that because the more stories like that, the more the narrative shifts. You know, instead of just defining our relationship to land as these few hundred years of slavery, now we're looking at 10,000 years of innovation and leadership. And that's a really different story.
Yeah, I agree with you. So, you know, because it does have a lot of history, let's pick one of the historic stories, one that I think is a direct line to you, and that would be Fannie Lou Hamer and her Freedom Farm. Could you tell the audience about that story that you tell in your book?
Oh, sure. So Fannie Lou Hamer is probably most well known for her work with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and her famous congressional testimony. But what a lot of folks don't know is that when she gathered all those civil rights activists around her at her home, she says to them, you know, if you have 400 quarts of greens and gumbo soup canned for the winter, nobody can push you around or tell you what to do. You know, and by extension, if you do not, then you can kick and scream and resist all you want. But as soon as they shut the grocery store down, you're going to go, begging the system to continue oppressing you because you're starving. And so she started a collective farm called Freedom Farm in Sunflower County, Mississippi. And a bunch of families got together. They had intentional community and housing. They were able to sell enough vegetables and hogs to pay burial fees and scholarships. They had a pig bank where they loaned out pregnant livestock so that other farmers could get access to the livestock and then return that sow to the bank. So they had a lot going on that really modeled what it was like to create a non-oppressive system and not just simply to resist the current oppressive system. So Fannie Lou Hamer is a big inspiration to us.
She's a pretty amazing woman.
Oh, yeah.
and there's a lot of other examples. Well, the one that you start off your book with is pretty serious about the weaving of the seeds into the hair. And that's a pretty moving story that somebody would think that far ahead before coming to America by being stolen out of their country.
Oh, yeah, it's incredible to me, especially because, you know, something I hadn't considered until I went and actually lived in Ghana, West Africa, is that people didn't get report backs. So it's not even that they knew they were going to America to work on somebody's plantation. They just knew that folks were getting kidnapped and disappeared into the sea. So that makes it even more astounding that our grandmas, 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 you know, way back, would, in the face of this terror of seeing people getting snatched up all around them, would gather up their okra and cowpea and sorghum and millet and all these seeds that they'd saved over generations and braid them into their hair because they wanted to give their children some insurance for an uncertain future.
Because in their minds, they knew that wherever they ended up, they could at least plant those seeds and eat something.
Exactly.
Wow. Yep. That's pretty heavy duty. Your book, you know, I think the best way to deal with some of the in our time here with your book is to go through the chapters. Would you mind doing that with me?
Sure, as long as you have them in front of you.
I do. I'll lead you along, okay?
Look, I don't remember what order they came in.
That's okay. Don't worry about it, Leah. You know, you start off with Black Land Matters, and then the first chapter jumps into finding land and resources. So that I know, I mean, owning land is hard to do.
It is, and it's especially hard to do in this country if you're not white, to be frank. You know, in the last USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture census, around 98% of the farmland was owned by white people, which is more racial disparity in land ownership than we've ever had in this country. And you know, this country was founded for white male property owners, and it really hasn't changed very much. And it's probably beyond the scope of our short conversation to get into the whole history of, you know, how folks were driven off their land as indigenous people and then again as black people. But suffice to say, it's very, very difficult if you haven't inherited land or wealth to own some land. And so there's some tips in there in terms of accessing programs, trying to encourage community members to engage in reparations of land and using tools like land trust to be able to access land despite these challenges.
Right. We're speaking to Leah Penniman, who wrote the book Farming While Black. It's a serious book on many levels. It addresses farming issues, like just basic things like weeding and soil quality and pests, but it also deals with funding and racism and reparations and empowering youth. It's a pretty comprehensive book on all levels, and we're talking about a couple of these different chapters here right now on Digging in the Dirt. I'm going to skip planning your farm, although, I mean, folks, if you want to plan a farm, this is the book. I mean, Leah's really gone through and lined it all up for you, but I love the idea that you want to tie spirituality to the land and to doing what you do on a farm. Could you talk a little bit about that? I know that there's a lot of different aspects to it in that chapter.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, again, going back to Ghana, where I lived for some time, my elders there had this fun game they liked to play where they would call me in and ask me questions about life in the United States. So one question they asked me was whether it was true if farmers in the U.S. would put a seed in the ground and would not pray, pour libation, or any other offering, sing, dance, or even say thank you to the land and expect the seed to grow. And of course, that's common practice. And they responded, that's why you are all sick, because you treat the earth as a material thing from which you can extract and not as a living being that is demanding of reciprocity and consent. And so the reason spirituality is in there is because it's inexorable in the African cosmology of how we understand the earth. You know, the earth is alive. The earth is a divinity. And there's ideas in there for how to honor the land with ceremony and offerings and song. And that also has a beautiful side effect of bringing a lot of joy to our lives and a lot of meaning to the work.
Sounds like we could bring a few of those ideas back here to the land where we pour NPK on everything.
Right.
That's our sacrifice to the earth. So now the next chapters, folks, runs through things like restoring the degraded land, feeding the soil, and I'm just really skipping over everything. Crop planning, tools and technology, and then we get to one that I want to talk about a little bit. And so if you need to find out about some of this stuff and are interested, the best thing is to get the book Farming While Black by Leah Penniman and check it out, because it is, like I said, comprehensive, a lot of stuff going on in this book. But I like to talk about seeds for a minute. I think this that story that you tell of your great-great-grandmother bringing the seeds here is part of that, but there's a lot to do with seed and seed exchange. What's your philosophy on that?
Yeah, so I'm really a baby in the seed-keeping world. I have to give a big shout-out to one of my elders, Ira Wallace of Southern Exposures Seed Exchange, as well as Owen and Chris at True Love Seeds, because you know, we were doing what everyone does where you save garlic and maybe some flower seeds here and there. And they said, look, you need to get on board with preserving these heirloom varieties, both the indigenous varieties from your land, the Stockbridge Muncie Mohican varieties, as well as these African varieties, because the stories aren't being passed down. And a lot of these varieties are getting lost in the seas of time. And so we've taken that really seriously in the past couple of years and started to teach ourselves and even offer some seed through the catalog. I'm very, very excited because Mama Ira, who's you know, an elder, and if we're lucky, probably has another 20 or 30 years with us, has said that her legacy project is to want to get a whole bunch of black growers together from across this continent to have a seed exchange of varieties that are culturally significant, things like the green glazed collard and the Moyamensing tomato and all types of okra and black-eyed pea. So we have some meetings coming up in the spring to plan what that will look like and to carry on her legacy, which is incredibly sacred work.
We have plant medicine, which I'm very interested in too, but that's sort of after you do all the other stuff, then you grow some additional stuff. But now we have, you know, complementary crops, you know, and you know, sowing of things that bring all the pollinators around. So I guess some of that would fit in this chapter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at first, the medicines, as you mentioned, were a little bit of a side thing. So we have a small orchard and we would, you know, plant herbs around the trees, which act as a attractant for pollinators and deter some of the pests. And they have a huge educational value. So when a young person comes to the farm, their eyes get wide when they realize that you can grow your own medicine. Like, wait, you don't have to go to Walgreens if you're having trouble sleeping. You know, you don't have to go to CVS if you have a mild cold or a sore throat. You can just make this tea. And so I have a habit of making these customized bundles for the young people who come. Mm. And they clutch them to their chest like a precious, you know, ingot of gold. They just, this is my, you know, medicine just for me from Mama Leah. So that's really special. But as we've become more sophisticated, I guess, in our crop planning, we found more ways to integrate herbs at a scale that we can give out in our farm share CSA and, you know, run our alliums up the edges of our beds and have whole fields of mint and so forth. So we're really excited to get that medicine and those culinary herbs out to the folks in our CSA who, by the way, I didn't mention this earlier, but we serve a predominantly low-income urban community with a number of refugee and immigrant families with a doorstep delivery program. So all this food that we grow on our acres, you know, goes to those who need it most in the community.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have a group here in Bridgeport, Connecticut called Green Village Initiative, and they're doing a lot of urban farming. You have a chapter on urban farming. That's becoming more and more important, isn't it? And it's like, and this project here in Bridgeport is really popular and a lot of people participate in it. And it's quite nice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those folks have come up to our farm, GBI. So we feel connected to y'all in Bridgeport.
Hey, there you go. But
yeah, of course, urban farming is so important for a number of reasons. One is, you know, we can grow quite a bit of food in urban spaces, especially when you talk about herbs and vegetables. They don't take a lot of space for the amount of nutrients that you can get. But additionally, they provide a connection to nature for folks who otherwise wouldn't have access, opportunities to build community, to build in ritual for elders and young folks to get together, you know, fresh air and exercise. And those things are not to be underestimated. You know, I read this really interesting book called Ecophobia by David Sobel, and it was talking about how if you teach young people about the environment through scare tactics, so if you tell them about the dire predictions on climate change and the rate of species extinction and follow them through to adulthood, they're actually more likely to have anti-environmental behaviors. To be jaded and discouraged. But if you encourage young people to fall in love with nature through direct positive experiences with the natural world when they're young, that correlates with positive environmental behaviors. And so those urban green spaces don't just provide us with food. They provide us with a whole future generation of folks who are going to take care of the earth.
Amen. So now we get to chapter 12, which is a one dedicated to cooking and preserving. And, you know, and after we do all this gardening, after you do your farming and you're exhausted and you've got all this excess, now you got to go to work preserving the stuff. And this is where I get in trouble. Sometimes I say, oh, I'm going to just freeze it, you know, but this is a handy chapter for learning a couple of the tricks of the trade from, like you said, from some of the older mamas. And it's a nice chapter to have. I mean, what do you recommend to people when it comes to preserving what they grow?
Well, I mostly freeze and dry things as well because I don't always make the time, and I admire those who do. But, you know, something that really struck me about some of my learning in terms of how to preserve is, while it's very, very easy to Google, you know, how to can a tomato, we lose a lot when we don't reach toward our elders in our community for that legacy learning. So I learned to can from Mother Isola in blessed memory. She actually just passed away a couple of months ago and luckily was able to see herself in this book right before she passed to the realm of the ancestors, for which I'm very grateful.
That's nice.
You know, but I went and picked her up at the assisted living facility where she was living and drove her down to the farm and gathered a bunch of young people around. And she was so amazing. You know, she told the stories of being in Mississippi when the only food that they bought from the store was sugar and flour. You know, everything else they had to can and preserve themselves. And she told us how to make sure the jar doesn't crack by putting a metal spoon in it, and, you know, how to get the air bubbles out and everything just right. And that cultural passing on of knowledge in addition to the skill was really precious for everyone who was gathered.
Listening to Leah Penniman talk about her new book, Farming While Black, which it's much more than just, even though it's aimed for the black community and to educate and push them to success, it's also for anybody who's interested in any of the subject matter we're talking about. And one of the subjects that I find interesting is that your dedication to the youth, you're very protective of the youth you're working with and educating them and opening them up to the potential of, you know, having a life around agriculture. I think it's admirable. Can you tell us a couple of the programs that you're doing and your philosophy of dealing with youth?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, something that I really appreciate about Soulfire is that everything we do has come out of a community ask and community demand. So none of these programs were just, you know, inventions of my own mind. We had some mamas who were getting our food delivery, and they called us up and said, look, our young people are getting harassed by the police in the summer because they don't have anything to do when they're out on the street. Can you take them and keep them safe and teach them some leadership skills and some land-based skills? And so that's where our youth programming really came out of, which is now includes adults who want to be farmers. And we have everything from one day to a year. You know, people come stay on the farm for a week for our 50-hour intensive Black Indigenous farmer training. We also have a camp for teens that we do in collaboration with Wildseed, and a whole mentorship program that we call Black Extension, like Black Extension Agency, to support our graduates. And, you know, our philosophy, we try to use a decolonized framework for teaching. We incorporate a lot of cultural ways of passing on knowledge, like using song and storytelling, using theater, and something called Each One Teach One, where we pass on knowledge within our community and do a lot of peer sharing. So it's pretty alive, pretty lively on the farm and very hands-on in terms of our teaching. You mentioned we're protective of the youth, and I will just say that a lot of folks will want to spin a narrative of the youth as victims. And so that's where we get protective and say, no, like if you're going to engage with our youth, they need to be agents of their own story.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, I'll give you an example. So we had a alternative to incarceration program called Project Growth for about 3 years. We kept 15 kids out of jail. So it was, we had to pass new legislation. The judge could elect to allow young people to accept this diversion, which is a 50-hour leadership course instead of going to juvenile detention. Now, the state, the county rather, had a really heavy hand on this program, a lot of assessments. They were pretty skeptical of the program. There's many stories I could tell about that, but they wanted to come evaluate the young people. So a bunch of suits coming up in clipboards or watching over these young black men bent over in the fields was not an image that we wanted to recreate. So we said, that's fine. Of course, you need to evaluate your program, but you need to come wearing work clothes, so work gloves and boots. And the way that you can evaluate it is that the young people will teach you how to do the farm skills that they've been learning. So they can teach you how to plant turnips or whatever the skill is. And then you will go ahead and do that. So you'll be able to see that they indeed learn the skill, that they can transfer the skill, and that you'll be engaged in a way more as equals with them rather than as these authority figures who are evaluating them without a real knowledge of what they're doing. So that's an example of what I mean by being protective of the youth having dignity and agency.
Makes sense to me. So, Leah Penniman, chapter 15 is a whole bunch of stuff where it's a movement building. It includes litigation, education, direct action, land defense, policy change, consumer organizing, and mutual aid and survival programs. I mean, that's a whole lot of stuff to do. But again, folks, this is like almost like a manual for doing some of this stuff. It's really admirable the way you put it together, Leah.
Well, thank you. I'm not sure I'm going to write another book, so I had to get it all in there.
You got it all in there, I think. I can't think of something you left out. But, you know, the last chapter we come to, and we'll spend the last of our time with it, is chapter 16 is White People Uprooting Racism and Reparations. And, you know, when the slaves were freed, quote unquote, when the slaves were freed, they were promised 40 acres and a mule. So you want to tell me about the history of this and also what is meant by reparations in 2019?
Yeah, sure thing. And I appreciate you saying this book is for everyone, because certainly we all eat and we all, for the most part, live on land. And so the responsibility of creating a just food system lies on all of us, certainly not just black folks. And right. That's what this chapter is really about. It's about all of our responsibility to repair this history. You know, it's not an accident that the land is concentrated in the hands of white people today. It's not an accident that farm workers don't have equal protection under the law, or that, you know, 85% of our food is grown by Spanish-speaking people with brown skin who don't own or manage their farms. And it's not an accident that black and brown people are more hungry and also have more diabetes and heart disease and obesity. And there's systemic racism. So reparations, very simply, means repair. It means looking at history and figuring out how we can do better. My elder, Ed Whitfield, tells a really neat little story that encapsulates it. He says, you know, imagine your neighbor came over and stole your cow, and then a couple weeks later, knocked on your door with tears in his eyes, apologizing for that crime and saying, you know, I'll make it up to you. I'm really, really sorry. You know, for every week for the rest of a cow's life, I'll bring you half a pound of butter. And of course, I imagine your response would be, I would prefer to have my cow back. But if we're not really talking about reparations in this country, we're instead talking about the half pound of butter, we can't fundamentally change the harm that's been done. So we need to make sure that the land is shared back. You know, that those unpaid wages are compensated, and that all people really do have access to the programs provided by the USDA and Extension and the land grant universities. And right now, all of those things are quite racially skewed. So we have a ways to go, but I really feel hopeful. I think we're at a dawning of a new consciousness around it and a willingness for everyone to take responsibility. And if we work together, it's not impossible. You know, other countries have engaged with the question of reparations with some success, and I have faith that we can do that, too.
Yeah, you do? That's good. I'm glad to hear it coming from you. So you're positive?
I am not certain, but I am positive.
Okay, that's good. What are your goals going forward here? I mean, what would you like to see happen in the near term and then maybe long term?
Well, you know, I'm really a child of the land. So on our farm, I just feel so excited that our programs continue to be more accessible to folks who have been excluded in the past. You know, we're doing a lot more with local indigenous community who unfortunately and tragically are ignored even in progressive circles. And we're doing a lot more with people who speak Spanish by having more interpretation in our programs, because we want everyone who wants a life on land to be able to have access to that. And our model for growth is that of mycelium. You know, we think of ourselves as one of the trees in the forest that's sharing our sugars and minerals and messages through a network of fungal hyphae so that other trees can grow strong. And so my vision of change is that more projects inspired by and in conversation with Soulfire are popping up and being strengthened all across this land, so that, you know, one day we kind of wake up and look around and see a food system that's really built on dignity and justice and sustainability.
That's a really nice image of mycelium. I like that. Yeah, there's a lot of disparate groups out there doing different things in the same niche, which I think is really important. I mean, the most positive stuff. I mean, you look around the political scene and it's kind of depressing. But if you look around the agriculture and farming and gardening scene, it's quite positive. A lot of people doing very interesting things and changing things. And I think you're one of them. And I appreciate what you're doing. So I hope you're right that all the groups are coming together and we'll make some massive change.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it took generations and generations to cause all this harm. And so we have to also think generationally. We can't just expect quarterly returns. You know, just like our ancestors braided seeds into their hair, believing in a future for us, we need to braid seeds, believing in a future for our descendants. And so I'm in it for the long game. I hope you are too. And I really believe that we will win.
Great. Well, Leah Penniman, author of Farming While Black, I appreciate you coming on my program, Digging in the Dirt, and talking to us. I'm sure people found it of interest.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yep. Take care and keep up the good work.
All right.
Digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.